All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I am obviously not at home, not in the studio. I'm in a motel room, a hotel room. What is the difference? I'm in a hotel room. It's 10 to 12 at night. I'm in Bend, Oregon, sitting with a half a loaf of bread. Some guy threw a loaf of bread on stage. What was it? A couple of weeks ago, someone threw some homemade candy pecans. But this guy at least waited till I was walking off, and all of a sudden, like a football, this fresh loaf of bread comes flying onto the stage here in Bend from the Rise Up Bakery. And I'm starving. I'm fucking starving. I just did like an hour and a half. I was only supposed to do an hour so I can tighten it up for HBO. That's not happening. I had a woman come down from Portland to open. She's very funny. Tori Ward. And I've been out here on the road for what seems like a long time. And it was wild. It's been a wild few days. Well, let me not get too lost here. Today on the show, Robert Siegel is on. He is the former editor-in-chief of The Onion. He wrote the movies The Wrestler and The Founder. He wrote and directed Big Fan with Patton Oswalt, and he was the writer and creator of the miniseries Pam and Tommy. He's got a new miniseries called Welcome to Chippendales with Kumail Nanjiani, and it's very good. Kumail's very good in it. Everybody's very good lately. Am I getting old? Am I letting go of things? He was good. They hid his massive muscular frame pretty well. Because we all know that underneath that, Kumail is ripped for his Marvel thing. But no, in this one, he's not supposed to be ripped. And they hid it well with clothing from the 80s. But it was interesting talking to Robert because he was kind of around in New York when I was there, and The Onion was very important. He was there when it moved to New York. So all in all, a very good conversation. Also, there are a few tickets left for the second show of my HBO special taping at Town Hall in New York City. That's the 9:30 show. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets or go to thetownhall.org. Oh my God, you guys, I'm fucking wiped. I did these shows in Oregon. I added a bunch of shows in order to continue preparing for the hour, which got moved up. So I needed to fill it in. So I booked shows in Eugene and Bend. I had booked a show, I believe, in Eugene a few years ago, but it just wasn't selling tickets. So I bailed. I don't think it was Bend, but these both sold out. And they were both pretty solid shows. There was definitely some issues in Bend, some poppy mic issues and there was some talky audience members, kind of dickish, but it was all good. But I'm just like, now I'm going to drive back to Portland 3 hours to take a plane from Portland to Burbank. This is how much I don't want to deal with LAX. I flew to Portland, and I could have flown into Eugene from LAX. I could have flown out of Bend to LAX, small planes. But I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to fly into Portland from Burbank, rent a car, stay the night, drive casually down to Eugene, and then casually over to Bend, and then a little panicky to Portland the next day, only so I can fly into Burbank. I'm flying back from Portland with a stopover. Unheard of, just to go to Burbank. That's how much I don't want to deal with LAX. Burbank's like 15 minutes from my house. But anyway, none of this matters if you don't give a shit about this stuff. I'm all right. I've been eating really badly. And I talked to a fan tonight who is a doctor who has some company that she's basically dealing with wellness around blood sugar. And I got to change my life, man. I've been on the road too long. I've drifted. I'm still exercising. Fine. I'm just not eating well. But it's just the nature of it. I'm tired, you guys. It's fucking midnight after a show and after I stuff my face with wings and a baked potato. and some chocolate pretzel peanut butter things. That's where I'm at. That's the party I'm at. Late night in the room, candy, talking to you. There's part of me that thinks I need to keep it down because of the other room. It's late. So I flew into Portland, and this is the weird thing. Like, I get there, and the hotel's pretty good, but I find out because of Twitter that Michael Ian Black, we were going back and forth, and he was in Portland, and I wasn't working. So I got to Portland. I went over and saw Mike over at Chip John, got suited up, because I brought the wrong jacket. I have a nice, warm Filson jacket. I'm like, but I kind of want to look cool. Brought the overcoat, chilly. But I went over to Mike's, and I got some pants, I got a shirt, and then my gloves were all fucked up, so I had to go back the next day and buy gloves. But Michael Ian Black was playing at Helium, and I haven't seen him do stand-up probably since the mid-90s. I don't think I've seen him in person in decades. And him and I have this weird, contentious Twitter thing that's kind of snarky and funny, and I always seem to lose. But I hadn't seen him, so I said, look, I'm in town. I'm just hanging out. Maybe I'll come by. He's like, come by. You can come on stage. I'm like, what? But I go over to Helium, and it was just like, you know, Michael and I have a past in the sense that, like, you know, I was a dick. And, you know, but we're both older. And I watched him do his stand-up, and it's very tight, and it's very specific and personal and funny. And I told him, I said before the show, don't bring me on stage. Don't disrupt the flow. I mean, if you're doing well, we don't need to fuck off. But he brought me on in the middle, and we just kind of went back and forth. He asked me some questions. We got some laughs. And then I got off, and he just went back into his act. But it was good to see him. I'm at that age where, you know, it's just good to see people are still alive. And he reminded me of David Cross, so I texted David Cross. I don't know. Just getting old, I guess. I went to the heart doctor last week because I just felt like I should go to the heart doctor because I was talking to people my age who, you know, were having clogged arteries, and I'd just been to the heart doctor. So I went back and I said, look, man, are you sure that I don't need to get an angiogram? He's like, what? And I'm like, I'm just like, you know, I'm just talking to these guys, and they, you know, they got their arteries clogged. He's like, yeah, but we did all these tests. I'm like, yeah, but I don't know, man. Can I just get a preventative one? And he was like, you don't have to. Let's just do this test. I'm like, all right, fine. I'll come back for that one. That'll make me feel better. So here's the other thing, though. One of the reasons why I flew to Portland is I just wanted to feel the Pacific Northwest. And I'd never driven to Eugene. That drive was okay. It was a little bright, not that interesting. But let me tell you, man, the drive from Eugene to Bend, stunning. And it just reminded me about what I loved about the Pacific Northwest. I used to think about it constantly. I was talking about the Pacific Northwest constantly. I really wanted to be up around Seattle or up even further north. I still want to be up in Canada and Vancouver, but there's something about the landscape here that really is overwhelmingly beautiful to me. And driving from Eugene to Bend was just, it just reminded me, it got me into that zone of just, you know, that spectacular pine forest, the big sort of, you know, heavy feeling mountains. There's all this lava stone everywhere. It was fucking great. I ate good food in Eugene. I went to a seafood place. They just boil crabs there. I don't know what I can tell you other than I'm tired and I got to shoot this special because I need a break. My body needs a break. But that aside, locking into the landscape up here and being able to lose myself in it was fucking great. And as I said before, the show in Eugene was nice. It was good. It was funny. The show in Bend was great. You know, sound problems aside. And now, like, I don't know. I'm just left to my own thoughts here in the hotel room. I couldn't live in this place. These are like these small kind of ski townish kind of places. I need to get home. I'm going to cook for Thanksgiving. What are you guys doing? What's going on? I'm going over to Gimme Dan's house. I think I'm going to smoke a brisket. I'm going to make a chess pie. And I'm going to cook some stuffing. What are you guys going to do? You going to cook? It'll be fun to cook. So look, Robert Siegel. Didn't know what to expect. Had a very pleasant conversation with him. Welcome to Chippendales premieres tomorrow, November 22nd on Hulu with new episodes Tuesdays. And this is me talking to him back in the garage. Do you live here?
No, I live in New York.
You still live in New York?
Yeah.
Huh.
Always. I've never lived here.
Ever.
Never.
You're just out here doing promotion, publicity, the junket thing for the Welcome to Chippendales.
Correct. Trying to get some people to watch the show.
What are you doing for that?
And there's a premiere tonight.
Oh, there is?
Yeah. Have we started? Did we just slide into it?
Are you familiar with the show? That's how it works. We're doing it.
I am familiar with the show.
It's happening. It's already happening.
I've seen it.
Yeah, it was happening in your car. I have this new technology.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, on the way over when you were on the phone. I got it all.
Oh, shit. You caught me berating my assistant.
So you live in the city?
I do. I live in what's now called Nomad, which is 30. They're trying to raise the rents and get the poor people out. They rebranded it Nomad, which is north of, great name, north of Madison, which
is north of Madison? Doesn't Madison run?
Exactly. Makes no sense. It's Madison Square Park.
Okay. All right. So, you stayed in New York.
So I'm on 30. Yeah, I'm like near. Right near Koreatown, where that is?
You weathered COVID through this in New York. The terrifying bodies in the streets COVID.
In an apartment with no outdoor space or anything. We made frequent use of Central Park.
Yeah.
My son's a fisherman. Uh-huh. So it was kind of great. It was
a fisherman,
like,
professional, like on the boats out of Queens?
Wants to be, kind of.
Yeah.
He's just obsessed with fishing. It's the only thing he's interested in. So we go to Central Park. We spent it was kind of nice because the city was empty.
Yeah. Hold on. I have to appreciate the fact that as opposed to say my son likes to fish, he said my son's a fisherman.
It's what he would put if he paid taxes, that would be on his tax form.
How old is he?
He's 14 now.
He's a fisherman. I like it.
Yeah, he's a fisherman. There's no other. He has no other defining traits.
Huh.
So I have to call him that.
How
anyone
often?
Who's met him would not dispute that.
Yeah. How often does he fish?
Every day. It's like heroin. Like, he needs a fix.
Wow.
Yeah.
My brother's got a kid.
He gets antsy and itchy and.
Huh. My brother has a kid that's that. He's a fisherman. He's a fisherman kid. Needs to fish every day or play with reptiles.
Yeah, yeah, we have reptiles.
Yeah,
we have. I think.
Oh, my God!
It's an adjacent. Probably diagnosable.
Does he have a lot of friends?
Yeah, yeah, all the fisherman community. There's like a on Instagram.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Does he deal with grown up fishermen? Like,
he aspires. Yeah, we're bad parents. We put him on boats with like 55-year-old men, sort of salty types that we just kind of roll the dice on, and
he's having the time of his life.
Oh, he loves it. Yeah. He goes to school on Governor's Island, which is do you know Governor's Island?
I do.
There's a fishing themed school there.
Really?
Called Harbor School. It's not really fishing themed.
It's Governor's Island. That's not Roosevelt Island. It's Governor's Island with the weird, creepy, abandoned hospital on it.
Yeah. There's like, they all have like abandoned sanitariums on them. Every island in the New York
area. Outside.
It's like the tip of the island near Battery Park.
Yeah. So he's going to be, he's taking this seriously. I love it.
Very seriously.
The fisherman thing. Yeah. And you're behind it 100%.
It's either go with it or fight it. And
Are you going to buy him a boat when he needs a boat?
It's extremely wholesome.
Yeah.
We'll buy him a, no, he's interested in freshwater fishing mostly.
Oh.
Right.
So this is not a profession.
Well, he wants to.
He wants to be a sportsman.
He wants to go to, get a bass fishing scholarship.
Yeah. Oh, good. All right.
Which apparently they offer in the South.
That's exciting.
Typical. Yeah.
Sure. So, what? I feel like we met somewhere because we were sort of in similar circles back in the early aughts.
Yeah.
With comedy.
Were you in New York?
Yeah.
In the.
I think I left New York. We left after 9/11, so we left 2002.
Okay.
And I left with Mishna. She couldn't handle it and. There anymore after that, and we came out here. But then I was back and forth a bit. But I mean, during that time when you were at The Onion, which was when?
I was at The Onion from 94 to 2003.
Yeah, so you were around?
Yeah, I was in my late 20s, early 30s.
Where'd you come from?
I grew up on, you mean like originally?
Yeah.
I grew up on Long Island.
Really?
Long Island, kind of Jewish suburbs. like the cradle of comedy. You know,
yeah,
like
which one?
Seinfeld.
Great Neck or?
No, Merrick.
Oh, Merrick.
Yeah.
I knew a guy named Eric from Merrick.
Eric from Merrick?
Yeah.
Oh.
So you came up there. Did you, you never tried stand-up or you never, how about
I tried stand-up once in college. I grew up, so I went to University of Michigan.
Yeah.
On a football scholarship.
Is that true?
No. So I went to Michigan.
Yeah.
I dabbled in the comedy scene there a little bit.
Yeah.
Just because I was interested in, my two interests were comedy and journalism.
Yep.
Which unexpectedly combined later on at The Onion.
It worked, yeah.
Yeah, because I didn't know there was such a thing as comedy journalism.
Yeah.
But yeah, in college, I wrote for the school paper at Michigan, and then, I also dabbled in stand-up comedy. I did it twice.
Yeah.
And I think I would have been, I sound like a real asshole for saying this, but I think I would have been good at it.
Yeah.
Because I just, I have the genes, like, you know, long, I mean, I come from the same soil as.
Yeah. Right, of all the Jews.
Of all the, you know, the, Ray Romano, Jerry Seinfeld,
sure.
Howard Stern.
Yep.
I fit the profile. I had, I had the dad who, you know, I had the difficult father.
What'd he do?
Like for a living?
Yeah.
He was a school school psychologist.
Really?
Yeah.
How was it difficult?
I shouldn't have brought that up because then I knew you were going to probe that.
He
was a difficult guy. A difficult relationship.
Yeah.
He was an unhappy, you know, volatile temper.
Uh-huh.
My point, I was only bringing it up to say that's part of
the
magic
genome.
That's part of the magic.
It's one of them.
Formula.
Dominating mother, you know, maybe, you know, a sort of slightly detached father. But I'm curious about psychologists in general. It's not, not necessarily a poking around at your father relationship.
He went into psychology, I think, because he had, you know, he had problems.
Yeah.
And he went to psychologists
right.
when he was young.
Yeah.
In his old journals, I read about his attempts
really?
To kind of figure. It was before, he really just needed to be on Prozac. And,
right.
And he would have been fine with
Is
this.
Is he around?
No, he passed away a couple of years ago. He was an older father. He was born in 1926.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was like an old dad.
So he brought a lot of baggage to the anger.
Yeah, no, I had a lot of baggage in the house with me. So comedy, I definitely, you know, I was sort of born and bred for comedy.
Sure.
So I did stand-up comedy once at the Union, at the Michigan Union.
Would you write jokes?
Yeah, I wrote some jokes, and I think I was really good. I think I could have been, I don't know, I feel like I could have been in that. I've always identified with stand-up comedians.
Well, I mean, I think that your skill as a joke writer, that can carry you a pretty long way, even if you're not inherently comfortable on stage.
I loved the on stage. I loved everything comedians say they love about doing stand-up comedy, just that rush you get, that it's like a, you know, it's described as a drug. That feeling you get when you get a laugh.
Yeah,
I mean, I've always loved that. Just in my personal life,
sure.
I'm always looking for people to make.
Yeah.
I like to make people laugh. But I just on my first time doing it, I got that feeling. But then I think I was lucky to also somehow on some level, I didn't really articulate it, but I recognized that it was going to be. It was a promising debut, but it was going to be, I sensed it was going to be that 20-year
hard life
grind to get to the top. Because, you know,
get to the top.
Maybe get to the top. But let's assume you're optimistic about it. You've got, I was 19 at the time.
Sure.
I was going to be staring down 20 years of that, you know, that chuckle hut.
Maybe. Existence. Yeah, I mean, but you know, It could have unfolded, though, is that you did stand up for like 5 years.
Who's the youngest breakout comedian you could name? I mean,
Chappelle was probably at 16 or 17, maybe 18.
I mean, I'm not Chappelle.
That was a million years ago. But what I'm saying is
he's just a supernatural talent. The average.
I don't know. Great. Like who really broke when they were younger?
Comedians break in their like 40s.
No, that's the old model, I guess. But you could have. Had the exact same life you had. You could have done stand-up for like 5 years, got the handle of joke writing, and realized there was more money in writing.
Yeah, except I wouldn't have imagined that.
I know. You don't know that at the beginning, but that could have been how it went.
I just saw a lot of depressing, It's just the comedy life. Just it just as someone who's prone to depression.
Yeah,
I just was like, "That's this is not a healthy. This wouldn't be a healthy."
Who'd you see? Hold on, I'm gonna move this in a little.
Who'd I see?
That led you to believe that this life was horrendous. Did you witness it up close?
No, like,
did you have friends?
No, it's so common. It's a cliche.
I don't know if it's really true.
You don't think so?
As time goes on, I don't. I know more sort of relatively
stable.
I don't know if I'd say stable, but the idea that we're all sad fucks. I don't know if that's entirely true. And the sort of Jewish model of, you know, neurotic depressos. I think that's sort of passed us by. I mean, it might have been true at some other point in time.
Okay. Well, The only person that just straight up cracks me up that to all appearances is an incredibly normal, well-adjusted person is Will Ferrell.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Wait for it to happen.
You wait for what?
For him to do it. I interviewed him once and he was just being normal. And I just sat there. I was sort of like, what's he going to do it?
When's he going to
make you laugh? Because he can do it effortlessly, you know, on purpose.
He had two loving... Apparently, I've never read his bio.
No, he's a well-adjusted guy.
He was in a fraternity at USC, two loving parents.
Just a funny motherfucker.
Yeah, but no one else. I mean, there are degrees of darkness to the rest of them, but I mean, I think they're all... I don't mean to be cliched about it, but they're all troubled to some degree.
Isn't everybody? It's like when people hang that on comics, I'm like, there's plenty of, you know, plumbers with drug problems. Plenty of cops with drug problems.
True.
Plenty of depressed.
Maybe we're all just...
I mean, well-adjusted people are far and few, but I understand.
It just didn't feel like it was going to be a healthy road for me. I'll just speak to myself.
I'm sorry that I pushed back on that, but it's only because I used to believe that. And the more people I talk to, especially people that come out of sketch, are a little more well-adjusted than these sort of lone wolf stand-up comics.
See, I would have been a lone wolf. I don't like sketch. I don't like improv.
Yeah. Yeah. You would have been a guy.
Improv irritates me.
But were you like a loner as a kid?
Yeah, I think so.
Awkward?
Yeah, awkward, loner. I mean, people probably didn't remember. I just wanted to fly. I wanted to be left alone.
You have siblings?
Fly under the radar and not be noticed. I have a sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She funny?
No, I hope it's Debbie. I love you. I think you would agree. I don't think of you as...
funny.
She has a dark... She appreciates my sense of humor.
Sure, because you come from the same stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And what did your mom do?
She was also a school psychologist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so where's... But that seems like a proactive liberal upbringing, no? I mean, was there like care given around growing up by with a couple of psychologists? Not really. Yeah, all right.
You know, it was the 70s.
Okay.
I don't know. I wouldn't describe them that way.
Yeah. Okay.
I love them.
Yeah. Good.
Well, they made me. I'm happy because they made me.
Yeah. I find that like as I get older, I had problems with my parents, and I talk about them still on stage, and you know, they're both still alive. But at some point, you have to see what's good about you and see if it came from them and give them a little credit.
Oh, I give them all the credit.
Wow.
All the credit.
Yeah. I definitely don't give them all the credit. I think I have to give myself some credit for somehow, pulling together a sense of self.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I give myself... Well, they give you the raw material. I mean, they give you the ingredients.
Yeah, and then they just cut you loose and then kick you around a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you go to Michigan... Well, you try stand-up, you decide that's not your thing. So where do the chops come from? I mean, what do you get a degree in?
History, of course.
Yeah.
I was a history major. I mean, I left Michigan. I really found myself in Madison, which was my next stop after that. Madison,
for
Wisconsin.
Graduate school?
No, well, not graduate school for me.
Yeah.
Graduate school for my then girlfriend.
Okay.
I was my girlfriend after college, who I met at Michigan, went to the University of Wisconsin.
And you followed her?
She was getting a degree in medieval English.
Oh, good.
And I had my history degree and...
Sat around reading Chaucer together?
Kind of. female medieval mystics.
Yeah, yeah. And the Green Knight.
A lot of Green Knight. Yeah. So I went to Madison with her because I didn't really have anything better to do.
Yeah.
And then Madison turned out to be the perfect place for me. I love it. I loved Madison. And it was like perfect because it was a medium-sized city.
Yep.
So it was big enough that there was, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life.
Yeah.
I was sort of a typical, you know, liberal arts major with creative leanings.
Yeah.
And I wanted to maybe write. Yeah. I'm not sure what I want to do. But Madison was a town where I was able to try things.
Yeah.
So it's, like I said, it's a big enough town where there is a newspaper.
Right.
There is a public radio station.
Yeah.
There's...
It's definitely hip, man. You know, and it's progressive and it's happening.
It was the greatest. So I would walk into, so I just wanted to try stuff. So I was in a city of 200,000 people where I could walk into the Wisconsin State Journal, which is the big state paper, and say, hey, I'm new in town. Can I write an article for you? You can't do that at the New York Times.
Yeah.
And, you know, to their credit, they let me try, you know, doing, so I just started doing little entertainment pieces for the State Journal, and I was volunteering for Michael Feldman's, do you know Michael Feldman? He's an NPR guy.
Yeah.
There's a show out of Madison.
Yeah.
I was just doing stuff, trying things, 21 years old. And one of the things I tried was The Onion, which was there at the time.
Was Todd in control?
Yeah, Todd was there, not in control.
Yeah.
But he was Todd already at that point.
Todd Hanson, yeah.
So I went and I just started writing for The Onion as a hobby, just more for fun.
Right.
I didn't think it was going to lead anywhere.
Yeah.
I did that kind of trajectory of hobby to job to career.
Yeah.
You know, you start with something that just turns you on.
But it sort of hit all your buttons, right? Brought back the comedy bug.
It was incredible because I got to make jokes and, you know, follow, you know, E.B. White's Elements of Style and AP format. And, and I had, like, I really took pleasure in exercising both of those chops because it was like being at a newspaper. It was more like being at a newspaper just as a, you know, from day to day there than it was being at a
comedy writing room.
In the writing room at Letterman or something.
Right.
Because we were, you know, deciding what was going to be the lead story and assigning stories and I was choosing photos. You know, the experience was...
A newspaper experience.
Almost. Yeah. I was an editor.
Yeah.
I was approving things and, you know,
so that was,
rewriting.
But you were just writing at first. How'd you become editor?
I became editor because, well, the old editor left.
What was his name?
The editor right before me was Ben Carlin.
He's the one who went to The Daily Show, right?
He was the producer of The Daily Show for many years.
Was he the original editor of The Onion?
No, it was the original. I mean, it's hard to, there was, really the original guy was Scott Dickers.
Right.
That's who most people, but he wasn't like the editor in chief.
Yeah, I remember that when I talked to Todd, you know, he had just kind of wandered in somehow.
Todd was washing dishes and he worked for a medical answering service. It wasn't really like the Lampoon,
right?
Where you had all these ambitious East Coast, you know, prep school people who came in with the intention of parlaying it into a career in comedy. It really was kind of more like a band. It was like a bunch of fuck ups. So that's kind of why it was easy for me to rise through the ranks there. I didn't come in with...
Because you took it seriously?
I didn't come in with...
Disciplined?
I was sort of... Well, it was a bunch of... And again, I'm generalizing, but it was all Midwestern, you know, Christian...
Yeah.
Midwestern Christian slacker college.
Yeah.
You know, it was the 90s.
Yeah.
It was like guys who listened to Pavement and
hanging around, smoking weed.
Yeah, smoking weed.
Drinking.
Wearing flannel, debating, you know, the merits of Beck's Odelay, whatever they were doing.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, not people who are particularly ambitious or great with deadlines.
But
and
funny.
I mean, the most talented, thrillingly funny. I felt like I had somehow stumbled upon the seven most brilliant. No, I thought, oh my God, this is like how it felt when, you know, Michael O'Donohue and the Lampoon and that whole crew or the Second City crew.
Yeah.
I really felt like I was in the company of geniuses, which I really, I still to this day think I was. But I was the only, I was sort of an East Coast Jew.
Yeah.
Amongst Midwestern Christian slackers, and it was it was just sort of like, you want to be editor? Sure. Nobody else
wanted.
There wasn't a power struggle.
It was too much work.
There was no power when Ben left, and there was a vacuum at the top.
Yeah.
There was no. It was like everyone just kind of shrugged and looked to me and was like, I think I was assistant editor at the time, making $75 a week. A little better with deadlines than the other people.
Right.
And so that made me the obvious choice.
You want to do it? That was it.
Yeah. I don't want to do it. You do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, off we went. And it was the same, you know, there's obviously been turnover since then. But when I was there, it was the same. Like I said, it was like a band. It was the same. To me, there was like, that was the classic lineup. You know,
was there is there any original members there?
The only still there today? Yeah. No, the only one left is the guy who is now who's been the editor in chief for many years, Chad Nackers, who when I was there was the assistant photo editor.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, he worked under Mike Lowe in the photo department.
But you were there when it moved, right? I mean, you were there when it blew up.
Yeah.
How did that happen when it moved to New York? Cuz I remember when that happened because it was sort of like they were everywhere all over the place.
Yeah,
seemed like around that post 9/11 episode was
That was our first New York. That was the first issue of The Onion to be published in New York. We moved in early 2001. I mean, really for no other reason than we were all kind of tired of getting lunch at Radical Rye on State Street.
Yeah.
We were just really, after 8 years.
Small town.
In Madison. Yeah. I was like getting sick of the sandwiches.
Yeah. Did everyone move?
And it was like Muppets Take Manhattan. We all got in our bus and off we go to the big city.
Yeah.
It was just a big adventure. We were all, you know, we all hunkered down in our Park Slope at the time, you know.
Yeah.
If you didn't have a lot of money, you went to Park Slope.
Right.
So we all got our Brooklyn. I actually was in Manhattan, but I think everyone else was in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And we lived, you know, and when we first got there, we were on the cover of the Style section of the New York Times, and we were sort of the toast of the town a little bit.
Yeah, you took over.
Yeah.
There was all those onion boxes everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Who bankrolled
you? The guy who owned it, his name was David Schaefer. He was like a hedge fund.
Oh, okay.
Like a big Lebowski.
Did he buy it? He always owned it, or he bought it and that's why he moved?
He bought it a while. No, that wasn't why we moved.
Yeah.
He bought it a few years before we moved.
Okay.
And then, no, we just wanted a change of scenery, really. And we wanted to get bigger.
Yeah.
I definitely had ambitions for the thing. I wanted to be in every.
And you're the editor at this point. And you moved to New York.
Yeah, I was the editor from. I think I was the editor from 96. I was the editor from 96 to 2003.
What did 9/11 happen before or after you got there?
Before. Well, we got there in January of 2001.
Okay, so then it happened.
9/11, I believe, occurred in September.
Yes.
Of 2001.
One. That's right.
Right. That was dry humor.
I got it.
So we were in town like setting up for a bunch of months. I don't remember how long, but we were like settling in for 6 months, still putting out the publication.
Yeah.
And then it hit the streets, and then we were all ready to go with our first issue in New York, which was going to hit the streets in September.
Yeah.
No, it was going to be like the week before September 11th.
Okay.
And then September 11th occurred, and we didn't publish for a week.
Yeah.
And then we all...
It was weekly, though, right?
Yeah, it was a weekly publication.
What was... I'm trying to remember that famous headline of the post 9/11. You know.
Which...
what were some of the stories?
I mean, the little... It wasn't a headline, but there was a holy fucking shit.
Right.
It was like the... There was, what was the lead?
Well, I mean, so, because like immediately it was like, is anyone going to be able to be funny ever again?
Yeah. We were like approached for everything. Every Time Magazine and Newsweek did a think piece on, you know, is irony dead?
Yeah.
And can we ever laugh again?
Right.
And of course, we gave the quote of like, you know, of course we're going to laugh again. Yeah, and we need humor as a way. I thought it was very obvious that humor is a way of.
Through. It's a way through
coping with, of processing terrible things and you know, pain and all that. This was before the Daily Show.
Yeah.
So I guess the idea of news
funny.
Jokes in reaction.
Yeah.
Jokes in regular reaction to the news was not like
outside of monologues.
Quite as obvious a thing as it is now. And the Daily Show and you know, Letterman. Letterman and SNL had shut down for longer than we did.
Yeah.
And we were sort of hailed as the first people back.
Longer than a week? I mean, you put it out like a week later?
Yeah. It was exactly 7 days later. We put out our first issue.
What was the reaction? You remember?
I still have like a stack of, we were nervous, but we got a stack of incredibly, you know.
Thank you.
Really moving, beautiful. Yeah. So this is the first, I mean, exactly what we'd hoped for, which right. is that this was, you know, the first time I've laughed.
Yeah.
It's that laughter that's, you yeah. know, it's that cathartic laughter through,
sure.
through tears thing, yeah. which is so beautiful. And it felt really, really good.
Were you paying attention to what The Onion was doing during COVID?
I have not. Since I left,
yeah.
I don't really look at The Onion
yeah.
because even to this day, if I do, it will, I just still
want to edit?
Yeah, I can't. I look at it occasionally, and yeah. I'll be like, that headline is three words too long.
Yeah,
there's an it lacks the precision and economy of where it's, you know, I
yeah.
there's
yeah.
a haiku.
Yeah. yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, you know, so no, I still it's I think it's I'm still too close to it to look at it, but I love it and proud of it. And
yeah, so you left in 2002?
I left 2003.
And what why?
Just because after 9 years of repetitive motion,
yeah.
mental repetitive motion, like seeing the world in headline form,
right?
It was just starting to make me crazy.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of use a different part of my brain.
And what'd you start with?
Well, before I left The Onion, I was maybe a year before I left The Onion, I was starting to get a little itchy to try something new,
yeah.
and we were approached to write an Onion movie
mm.
by David Zucker of Airplane
sure.
fame.
Yeah,
he grew up in Wisconsin, and I think he sort of saw us. He took a liking to us as, I guess, I can only presume, the heirs to some sort of Wisconsin comedy tradition.
Sure.
So he approached us about doing an Onion movie, which didn't go well, and it went straight to video and all that. But it was my first time writing a screenplay.
Right.
Todd and I were co, you know, the whole staff wrote it, but we
in touch with him?
I haven't spoken to him in a while. Mm. No.
Wonder
I
how
should.
He's doing. All right. So, but that seemed like a long time, the release of the movie and, if it's correct, the movie came out much later than when you finished it.
Yeah. It knocked around for, 2 or 3 years. It kind of languished in development hell and eventually trickled out to, you know, cutout bins. It was not a smash hit.
So what were you doing?
So I just loved, it was the first time I ever wrote in Final Draft.
Okay, right.
Just in screenplay format.
Sure.
And it was just exciting. And
yeah.
It felt like an exciting new thing to try. And I just started writing screenplays. While I was still at The Onion, I started dabbling with screenplays.
What was your first one?
In my spare time. I don't remember, I sort of blocked out the specifics of, they were all comedies.
Yeah.
I'll say that. I mean, they were sort of broad comedies. I did that classic thing where you write what you think is going to sell, what seems to be in vogue.
Right.
I also just assumed because I was a comedy writer, I needed to write comedies. So this was during the sort of heyday of like Ben Stiller, Will Ferrell, like old school. I think old school
Right. So like, you're trying to do that. So you knock out, you do a few scripts, you got an agent, you're trying to sell them.
Yeah, I had an agent just through, I think I already had my agent because of The Onion.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of taking a chance on me as I moved into this new thing.
Sure.
So I wrote a series of comedy, like pure comedy.
Yeah.
And they were probably the kinds of things that pass through the desk of low-level Hollywood script readers all day long.
Right.
But were not particularly, didn't have a particular voice.
A lot of jokes.
Yeah. An attempt to write old school.
Sure.
And
which had some funny moments. Some great Will Ferrell moments.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have nothing against that movie, but that's just not the right approach.
No.
It's
a vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to, it's not the right, I was just discovering the powers of self-expression writing what you know, getting through that mistake of writing what you think will sell and what you think. So I was sort of writing down, and I also made that mistake of, I think a lot of screenwriters when they start out think the dumber and the worse the thing you're aiming for, the easier it is to do.
Right.
One of the first like really eye-opening breakthrough moments I had with screenwriting was, I've only once been invited to a punch-up session, which is where they just call, you know, once a script has already been written, they have a bunch of, they bring in a bunch of writers to just add
jokes.
For what movie? It was for a date movie.
Yeah.
which was one of those. Do you remember those like spoof, like scary movie?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Was it a Wayans Brothers thing?
No, it wasn't. It was these two. I forgot their names.
Was it made?
Yeah, yeah. Date movie.
Date movie.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, it was a hit.
Okay.
Like Miramax. I think it was Miramax would crank them out. Yeah. They were like cheap to make and they made a lot of money.
So you were working for Miramax, kind of? They hired you?
My agent was just like, you want to get $1,000 to go to the Beverly Hills?
Yeah.
I was, you know, the Four Seasons.
They flew you out?
No, I happened to be out here. That's the only reason I was invited.
Huh.
Was I happened to be out here and my agent was like, hey, while you're in town, there's a punch-up session for a date movie at the Four Seasons.
How'd that blow your mind?
It blew my mind because I thought it would be a bunch of people sitting around very cynically, like everyone around the table would know that what they were doing was shit.
Yeah.
And instead, what I found was they were all really into, and I was coming at it as like Mr. Onion comedy snob, you know, like, you know.
I know what I'm doing.
Meta comedy and anti comedy.
Right. Sure.
Michael O'Donohue.
Yeah.
And here, this is the crassest, lowest form of comedy. And what I learned was that they all were really, really. I was the only one at the table. I think I was probably kind of a standoffish dick.
Yeah.
I'm sure nobody probably even noticed me, but I was like, oh, they love this. Like, they really love this. And for me, that was kind of really eye opening. Like, oh, you have to, even if. No matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
I just thought, like, when you write shitty...
Sure.
You're
just bitter and you're just doing it for money and you hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they're hate writing.
Yeah.
They're hate joking. And they weren't. They loved it. They all were really, really psyched. And I was like, oh, okay. So I have to... The lesson was, right, like, just... Even when you're doing that kind of comedy, it's always done with love and sincerity. So I just, almost as an experiment, I stopped. I said, okay, let me stop writing these... comedies that have, you know, somewhere in there, there's like cynicism in my, there's like, it's not written with love or sincerity.
Right. So why do it?
Certainly if it's not working, you're not enjoying
it
somewhere. So I wrote, so I just took a look. I walked over to my DVD collection in my apartment.
Yeah.
This was the heyday of DVDs.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, my DVD collection is... You know, Midnight Cowboy and Fat City and Saturday Night Fever and Taxi Driver and Mean Streets and, you know, it's like Scorsese and Hal Ashby. And I'm like a 70s
anti-hero, gritty.
Yeah, Hope of Greenwich Village. Yeah. That's my shit. Like, that's just what I love.
Jolly!
Yes. They took my thumbs. So that's what turns me on. So I was like, let me try writing... I know this is not commercial. This is not going to sell for $1 million, but let's just try writing one of those movies. And what I wrote was what's turned out to be Big Fan, which was
Patton Oswalt as the sports fan. It's great.
Which, thank you. So it didn't, what that did was it was the first thing I wrote that was, and it was the first success, it was the best screenplay I wrote. And it was the most.
You think it was the best screenplay
you wrote
looking back?
Well, at that time, it was like worlds. It was it was an actual screenplay original.
Yeah, the turn at the end was great.
Thank you.
Because I didn't know it. Yeah, so like, and I watched it. And, you know, he's a peer of mine, so I didn't want him to be good, but he was great. And Rappaport I love.
He's amazing.
But he is. But the turn at the end was great. But why that subject matter? What was it that compelled you?
Because I grew up listening to... So it's about a... for the 99% of your audience who don't know the movie, it's about this obsessive New York Giants fan who is beaten up by his favorite player.
Yeah.
And the crisis of conscience that creates in him.
Yeah.
It's like a dark character study.
Sure. Like those movies you looked up to.
Like those movies I love. So what I did was I kind of took... The movies I loved, and I fused it with this other thing that I love, which is sports.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen a movie about a sports fan before. And I grew up, I guess if it's personal at all, it's because I grew up listening to sports radio.
Yeah.
WFAN in New York.
You know,
when I was growing up on Long Island, that was the first sports radio station, and it started in, I think, probably 1987.
Uh-huh.
So I was in high school, and that was the first.
And you love sports.
I loved sports, and this was a time before sports radio existed. So the idea of like hearing people rant about sports
Yeah, callers.
Callers
stuff, yeah.
Ranting about sports was, it didn't exist prior to WFAN.
Right, right.
And it didn't exist on TV.
Right.
So I'm lying there. I would listen to it every night in my, in my, you know, suburban Long Island bedroom with the light, with the lights out. I would be tired every day going to school because I would turn on my radio. I'd, you know, I'd go to bed at 11 o'clock or whatever it was. Yeah. I'd turn on WFAN and I would just stay up for hours listening to these voices.
Aggravated voices.
And they were people who were kind of reminded me of Ratso Rizzo.
Sure.
And
Travis.
And Travis Bickle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Johnny, you know, Johnny Boy.
Fully obsessed.
They were like psychopaths, but they were also, they also all shared with those movies. They were like Outer Borough New York weirdos, which I don't know if that's a genre, but like, you know, Tony Manero, Ratso Rizzo, Johnny Boy, Pope Grinch. They're all like weird. I love movies about, you know, I love outsider characters. I identify with outsiders, but I particularly, there's something about people just staring across, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge, looking at the Manhattan skyline that's so close yet completely out of their reach.
Right.
It just hits me like nothing else. So for me, listening to these callers, you know, Joey from Kew Gardens and Ray, and you get to, and it's very intimate. You get to know them. You know,
they're regular, they call every, all the time.
And you start to, and you form these relationships with them. And it's, and for a Long Island suburban Jew, like, you don't ever meet people from Maspeth, Queens.
Yeah.
So like just hearing these people from so close to where I grew up, but like completely from a different universe, you know, these working class blue collar guys with these crazy, you know, each with these accents, you know, because the New York accents.
Right. There's nothing like it. That there's something comforting and terrifying about it.
I wanted to know what, I was fascinated by them.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to write movies about them.
Yeah.
I didn't think of it in those terms at the time, but yeah.
Because
and I did. So that's what I wound up doing, was writing a movie about one of those guys.
It's because Patton's not essentially that guy. But, you know, in terms of like, I didn't get the feeling like he was some sort of Queens character.
No, he does. Well, you know, we played with a Queens accent and it didn't work. So we
let him do him.
Yeah. I just thought, okay, let's just.
Sure.
Better no accent than a bad accent.
And then Rappaport, he'll do it, does it twofold. So he'll cover for it.
Yeah. Except he's doing a New York accent.
Right.
When I rewatch that and beat myself up, you know, it's not a Philly accent he's doing.
Oh,
but that's just the perfectionist in me.
That's right. It's good. It was good.
No complaints. Yeah. No. So I wrote that, and then that kind of kicked around. That became my calling card for like getting jobs.
How'd that happen? So it went around to directors?
You submit it to your agents, and then it just floats around.
Yeah.
It floats around Hollywood and people read it and they like it, and they, you know, it gets you meetings and it gets you, gets me like low level rewrite work at first. It was a foot in the door to like to my first professional writing gigs, which were kind of low level rewrite jobs. But then at the same time, that script is also making the rounds to directors. So it eventually reached Darren Aronofsky, who
was he in New York? He was in New York, right?
Yeah, he was in New York at the time, and he really loved it and was interested in directing it.
Yeah.
And he was going to. The problem we kept running into was the NFL issue, because it's their real teams.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do the most sports movies, particularly then, you know, like any given Sunday, it's the Miami Sharks, you know, versus the Baltimore Dragons or whatever.
And they put $1 billion into that movie.
It for me as a sports fan, it ruins the movie.
Yeah.
I can't get past that it's the Miami Sharks and not the Miami Dolphins, because it's so much a part of the culture of. So I was like, I'm not doing this.
That's weird, isn't it? Because like, I remember North Dallas 40, but like, I don't think they ever mentioned the team, did they?
North Dallas 40 was supposed. I mean, it was supposed to be the Cowboys,
Of course,
but they're called North. Why would you have a team called North Dallas? It was a fake team.
Well, I get it. I guess because I'm not a huge sports fan, it was so clearly the Cowboys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for me, that's enough. That wrecks the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially if it's a movie about, like, where you're really, embedded in the culture. I mean, yeah. I mean, the New York Giants are part of New York culture.
Sure, sure.
So the New York Wizards, to me, I wouldn't do it. That was like a deal breaker. So I was like, I'd rather not make this movie than make a movie about the New York Wizards.
Yeah.
So eventually, you know, enough people passed on it that everybody passed on it because they all have, like Fox Searchlight wanted to make it with Darren, but Fox has $1 billion contract with the NFL that they don't want to jeopardize
over your little movie.
Stupid fucking $1 million Searchlight movie.
Yeah.
So it kicked around to a bunch of directors. I took meetings, but it was apparent that it was never going to get made.
Yeah.
And I just reached a point where I didn't even have any real dreams of becoming a director, but I just wanted the movie to exist.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't want all the effort I put into this movie.
Yeah.
And I felt like at the time it was the best thing I'd written, and I just wanted it to exist.
And it didn't happen.
I just made it
then.
It happened
later.
Yeah, no, it kicked around for 5-6 years, and then I was just like, fuck it, I'm doing it myself.
But that was after you met Aronofsky, how'd that happen?
Years later. He approached me because I think he just got a hold of that script somehow, however one gets a hold of a script, and he said I wanted to. I met with him about it. That's how I came to write The Wrestler, was years later. So we didn't do Big Fan together, but he wanted to do a movie set in the world of wrestling.
Yeah.
And I guess he's like, a gritty character.
Yeah.
Gritty character study set in the world of the sort of underbelly of sports.
Sure. That's what he wanted to do.
He wanted to do that. So he's like, oh, what about that guy who wrote that Big Fan script?
Were you a wrestling fan?
Yeah. Not obsessive, but I'm a child of the, the 80s. I would go to Nassau Coliseum and see Hulk Hogan and the rest of the gang.
Who was your favorite wrestler?
I liked Coco Beware because he had a parrot. Jake the Snake, everybody loved. Jimmy Superfly Snuka.
Yeah.
I just loved, I don't know, I wasn't such a fan that I had like posters on my walls.
But
I loved the spectacle of it. And it's really just fun to do you know, it's all kind of a put on, but it's fun to scream.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but when you're conceiving that character, who were you thinking about?
I would say probably Terry Funk, it was kind of a composite of a few guys. You know, there's the masochism of like a Terry Funk, and then there was also Mankind.
Yeah.
Who else was? Jake the Snake, because he was this really tragic. I mean, a lot of them are really tragic figures, but Jake the Snake was this, got addicted to crack. I would go to these events.
Did you watch the Matt movie, Barry's movie, before?
Beyond the Mat?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a huge influence on it.
Yeah.
That's definitely kind of the direct
connection.
Direct connection. But and then I started to go to these events, which were
signing events?
No, they were wrestling shows all around the New York. I mean, they have them all over the country, but like I would go, it's this secret world. I love secret worlds. I love subcultures.
Yeah.
That's usually what turns me on in deciding what to write about is like a world, not a story.
Right.
So I didn't even really know it was going on right under my nose, but like on any given weekend in the New York area, there's a Knights of Columbus Hall in Queens and a church basement in Passaic, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And they would have these wrestling cards, and the cards would always be a mix of guys on their way up who want to be wrestlers but probably don't have the chops and never will make it. And then the guys on the way down. And they would usually, to get a crowd to show up, they would hire one of these
beat up guys.
One of these old beat up guys that like really just needed a $300 payday. So I would see like, George the Animal Steel. I saw Tito Santana.
Yeah.
All these guys who I saw, 15 years earlier, I saw at Nassau Coliseum, on the card with Hulk Hogan. And now they're playing, the Passaic VFW Hall for probably $200, and they can't, most of them can't move. So a lot of times they would put them, it's kind of how Steven Seagal movies are made now. You run into his fist, you know what I mean? He doesn't move much.
Yeah.
So, Tito Santana with his taped up knees would be standing in the middle of the ring like a horse they're about to put down.
Yeah.
And guys would run into him and just bounce,
So it's heartbreaking.
It's so, so heartbreaking. And there's so much, you know, it's there's pathos and it's just fucked up and it's funny. To me, it's, you know, I don't mean to say that like callously, but there's...
Well, yeah, because the put-on is still in place, but it's completely broken down.
Yeah. There's a dark,
yeah,
strange perversity to the whole thing that just appeals to the comedy. I'm attracted to things that are...
Because they're volunteering to do it, whether it's desperation or not. That's what they're holding on to.
And they're happy to... And on some level, and there is a... And while it's also pathetic, there's a real beauty and dignity to it because they are... they're getting the same thrill because you can see.
Yeah,
it's a funny thing. Like the cheers of a crowd, whether it's Madison Square Garden or whether it's the Passaic VFW Hall.
Yeah,
and whether it's 20,000 people or 75, you know,
people
drunk assholes.
Yeah,
when you get a crowd excited, it's that same rush.
Yeah.
So you could see why these guys are still, aside from needing the money, there's some element of it that they're still addicted to.
Yeah.
It makes them feel good. It feeds their ego and it makes them feel like they're making people happy.
Well, I mean, the script was kind of amazing, you know, in terms of your empathy and your understanding of that guy.
I have tremendous empathy for those guys.
Well, you can feel it in the wrestler. And I think Aronofsky handled it very well.
He did incredible. Yeah, I mean, they're artists and they sacrificed. I mean, that's a big theme of Aronofsky's, obviously, and I could see why it appealed to him. You know, these are guys who, you know, sacrificed their bodies for their art.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a Christ, you know.
Yeah.
I always slip in a little Christ thematics into things. Well, these are guys who are dying for our pleasure, you know.
How engaged in the process were you when he started directing?
Then I was mostly just like a happy... visitor to set, and that was my first movie that got made. That got made before Big Fan,
right?
So Big Fan was still kind of languishing,
but it did very well. The Wrestler,
it did great. It won the Venice. It was thrilling. It won the Venice Film Festival and
big time.
And you know, Mickey got his Mickey and Marissa both got Academy Award nominations. It was a thrill ride. It was like a dream first.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And that opened the door for you to be able to direct Big Fan?
It didn't even open the door. I just did it.
Oh, yeah.
I did it because I paid for it with my own money.
Okay. So you just chose. You just
I was
said,
just
I'm
like, that was just getting my wife's permission.
Sure. To spend the money.
Or blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, hey, we have, I took the money. I took the money I made selling my Onion shares. I had owned a 5% stake in the Onion, and I sold it. And I took that money, and I made Big Fan with it.
And how was that received? Pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it got into, you know, it was in competition at Sundance, and it's had a very slow burn of a life. It's still. It got distributed. I mean,
I saw it.
It was fine. I made my money back, and some people have heard of it. And what more could I, you know?
Interesting.
What more could I ask for?
That's right. But I mean, I you wrote The Founder too, which I like that movie a lot.
Thank you.
Script. I mean, but it seems like heading towards Welcome to Chippendales. You know, through The Wrestler, Big Fan, The Founder, Pam and Tommy. Like, there's a world that you seem to occupy in the American landscape that seems to be fascinating to you.
Well,
there's a similarity between those things.
I hope so. Some people think that when they talk about I like American pop. I like things that are really poppy that deal with, I know it sounds kind of vague, but I like things that are about America.
But it's interesting that these things, right,
like
wrestling, sports fanaticism. Fast food.
Yeah, junk pop. I like pop culture.
Porn and hair metal.
Yeah, I love that shit. I love fun. I love fun, trashy.
Dark fun.
Yeah, I like things that are about music or sports.
Well, how'd The Founder come to be?
Or, you know, hair metal. Because
that's sort of the
Founder,
outlier. Yeah.
Well, that's like, you know, McDonald's is a major, major part of America.
Yeah. How'd you get that project? Was that something you chose?
I was approached to write that.
Oh, okay.
And I read Ray Kroc's autobiography, and it, you know, that checked my, that kind of scratched my Citizen Kane, you know, big controversial, polarizing. I like I like unlikable protagonists,
yeah.
which is why I've eventually kind of migrated to television, where it's less of an issue.
Yeah, right.
But
because you have many episodes too.
I like things that are, I mean, fun.
Yeah.
That appear to be where the entertainment is on the top.
There's yeah.
And then there's vegetables. You know, there's substance underneath it.
Where substance and darkness and
you
weirdness.
Can choose to just enjoy sure. it for just the fun of it and the entertainment value. But there's also like. Themes.
Well, you can, but like even with the Welcome to Chippendales, like you can choose that, but you know, you're going to have to reckon with those characters at some point.
Yeah, definitely. And they're dark.
And the same with Pam and Tommy.
Yeah, I like dark, unlikable people that, you know, that we understand. I don't, that whole thing about likability, your character has to be likable, I think is.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
It's becoming an outdated notion, thank
sure.
God. But for a long time, it was really like gospel, and certainly in film.
Do you think it's something historic with you, or just as an aesthetic decision? Do you think it's some you're kind of like reliving your relationship with your father over and over?
Well, again? I mean, everything I write is about him, or reckoning with him, and it's all about masculinity and what it means to be a man, which is why, I mean, I don't remember what movie it was, but my sister went to one of my premieres and she's like, that was Dad. I was like, what? I don't think about it.
Right, right.
You shouldn't ever think. I try not to ever think about what something's about.
Sure,
I can't tell you what anything's about.
Yeah.
But it's all my dad.
Yeah. 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 Reckoning.
Yeah. Just the things, the fucked up messages our parents give us and the things they don't teach us. I got most of my like parenting from my two heroes are Bruce Springsteen and Howard Stern.
Yeah.
Like those are my guys.
Those are your dads?
Those are my dads.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad was my dad but those are my guys, you know, the dark and the light.
Yeah.
For me, Howard and Bruce were, you know, Bruce, I really listened to his songs when I
played. Yeah.
I sound like such a fucking middle-aged man, but.
Well, you definitely sound like you're from Long Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I just listened to his songs and they kind of taught me how to.
Yeah.
How to be a man and how to live the right way. And I wanted to be a good person.
So did he.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he struggled. I didn't even know. I thought he was just kind of preaching to. I didn't know he was struggling with all that stuff.
That book is crazy. Oh, when I interviewed him, it was crazy. I mean, that book is great.
His, yeah.
Because you wouldn't have, he didn't assume it. How would you know that?
It seems so obvious now in retrospect.
Exactly. That's true. It
I'm like,
does.
How could I not think this guy
was tortured and hard on himself?
Right, and depressed.
Yeah, I know. Because he's got that thing he does, like, hey, everybody, I'm here. You know.
Yeah, no, he's become like a Mount Rushmore, just almost not a person, but a
statue. Right, and you listen to Howard all your life?
Yeah, I listen to Howard every day, obsessively.
Growing up.
To the Yeah, growing up, and then really, I mean, it's just only gotten deeper and deeper.
Have you been on?
No, I wouldn't qualify. I mean, hopefully something. I mean, maybe this will be a stepping stone to that. But he interviews fucking.
I know.
Well, you do too. I have no idea why I'm on this show, but by the way.
Yeah, I have a lot of range. Howard's like a celebrity guy. I did Howard once, but he's been talking about me lately.
Oh, he has?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of
about my role in To Leslie. He said something.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
he loves To Leslie, his friend.
And then he talked about my Gallagher episode. I think yesterday he brought it up.
Oh, shit. I haven't listened to yesterday's yet. I'm behind this week.
But so you are resolving these issues. But now the Chippendale thing, like, you know, I've known Kumail a long time, and he's really acting the fuck out of this thing. He's doing a great job.
Thank you.
It was great.
Have you seen any of it?
So I watched four.
Four of them.
I'm four in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay.
Because I can give you reasons why I think it's great. Well, I mean, you found, this is all you, right? You came up with this idea for this?
Yes and no. I mean, I tried to write a version of, I wrote a Chippendales, it's not worth going into the long version of this, but I wrote a Chippendales movie years ago that I tried
about
to
get, him, about Steve, what's his name?
Steve Banerjee, who I tried to get Kumail for. I was originally hired to write it for a Bollywood actor named Amir Khan.
Yeah.
And that never got made.
Is Steve still alive?
No.
Okay.
As you'll, well.
Okay. Yeah.
Watch,
yeah.
Watch
I'm sorry.
The rest.
I mean, I had no idea that Dorothy Stratton and Paul was.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Paul Snyder.
Were
Star 80. It's like
It happened. They were involved.
It's like the extended Marvel universe. Yeah, they
it is.
Paul Snyder of the Star 80, Eric Roberts played.
Who killed Dorothy Stratton and then himself.
They were in the scene.
Yeah.
In the early days of Chippendales. And she was the one who came up with the cuffs and collars idea.
And that's all documented.
Yeah, it's real.
It's crazy, man, that time.
It's a crazy true story. It's unbelievable.
But to ride that line that you're riding, that you'd like to ride, where, you know, this is like, it's dark stuff, man. Hollywood is always got that dark stuff, but that, you know, that little chapter of those two is horrendous.
Yeah.
And somehow or another, in light, you know, the way it's played in the film, because you actually get attached to those two characters in the first two episodes, but you know what's going to happen to them. Anyways, but you know, it's how it's balanced through Kumail's journey where it doesn't, you know, kind of, you know, pull the plug on the thing.
No, there are many dark chapters along the way, and they were kind of the first.
Yeah.
You could see them as sort of an omen.
And he's not a particularly likable guy.
Steve? No, but he's interesting, and he's got all the stuff I would want.
Well, yeah, it's all very uplifting, because you have that music of the time in the 80s, and then you have these women who are great, and these dancers who are, it's all very, and I like all the fucking. I like that everyone's—
You have fucking, you have cocaine.
Everyone's fucking everyone. Yeah, we've seen that before, but—
Thongs, mullets.
Sure.
Yeah, it's got—
But there's something, I mean, you're really letting them fuck in this movie, in this miniseries, which is good.
Do I? Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, there was some serious fucking male gay sex, which you don't see that much, you know. Yeah. And there's some serious, you know, just in the dressing room, the green. I like it. There's just people fucking everywhere.
Casually fucking,
exactly,
in a way, I
with
think.
Other people in the room.
Yeah, which they did back
sure.
then.
Sure. Yeah, but I'm not saying that he's an unlikable guy. You know, the immigrant story. You know, in terms of their expectations of themselves and what they're up against, you know, generationally, I think is handled very well. And, you know, his sense of what the American dream is, and the fact that, you know, he and Paul Snyder shared this obsession with Hugh Hefner.
Yes.
Was kind of synchronistic and interesting.
Steve's twin heroes were Hugh Hefner and Walt Disney. To him, he grew up in India, and he came to America in the late 60s. And to him, Hugh Hefner and Walt Disney were the epitome of American success.
Yeah.
We didn't really delve into the Disney side of it, partially for reasons of lawyers. But
sure.
But Hugh was, to him was sort of, you know, and by Hugh, I mean like the Hugh of the 60s Playboy Club with the, swanky.
Classic Hugh, yeah.
You know, with the hi-fi stereo.
Well, it would also be like
hanging
the
out with Dick Gregory.
70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was his dream, was, you know, his assimilation dream was to, you know, I think when he first came to America, he came up with Chippendales 7 or 8 years at, almost 10 years into his time in America is when he came up with Chippendales. And those years are kind of where he went, took the detour, because when he first came to America, I think if you had asked Steve when he first landed in America, what is your ultimate fantasy of American success, he'd say, I would own a dozen gas stations.
Right.
You know? But he had this 10-year period of soaking up American pop culture.
Right.
You know, and watching, he was one of these guys that learned to speak English watching TV.
Right.
You know, so he's sitting there alone in his little Marina Del Rey apartment watching The Love Boat and the ads for, you know, Asti Spumanti, whatever.
Yeah.
And it changed him, and it changed his definition of success from just being rich to being something more classy.
That idea of classy.
Like Trump, you know, doesn't just want to be rich. He wants to hang out. He wants to be invited to the good parties and hang out with Tom Brady. You know, like Steve definitely wanted to be in the in crowd. And the in crowd is white. And he's not white, and he'll never be, you know.
Yeah.
So he came here, I think, with this feeling like in America, because in India they have this very strict class system.
Yep.
So I think when he came here, he thought, well, in America, it's, you know, you can be anything in America. and he started to find that he could not escape his skin color.
Yeah.
And then he started, one of the fascinating things about him that we deal with in later episodes is he starts discriminating. He becomes racist himself, and he doesn't let black people. That was in your episode.
What was it? I saw the Otis Leaving episode.
He creates these VIP cards. Yeah. The real Steve created VIP cards to keep as a means of keeping out undesirables, aka non-whites.
And
so he's fascinating.
Well, I'm going to have to see how that plays out. But in terms of, it seems to encapsulate all the things that you're interested in. And and Kumail's doing such a fucking great job.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
I love working with stand-up comedians. You know, I worked with Patton, and now I'm working with Kumail. Yeah. They have such stuff to tap into.
Yeah. Well, so I'm sure he's got things within that character to tap into.
Oh, as he will discuss at length on his press tour this week. Kumail is, you know, I've heard him talk about it. I mean, Kumail definitely relates to aspects of the character.
Yeah.
You know, he came to America. I think Kumail came here when he was like, he came here for college. He went to Grinnell in Iowa.
Yeah.
So he's this kid from Karachi, Pakistan, dropped in the middle of Iowa on this, you know, bucolic little campus with kids, you know.
Yeah. It's all like that story of people who come here to do this thing. And you seem to be, again, pretty fascinated with this particular version of the American dream.
Which version is it?
Well, you know, this trashy pop culture version.
I just think it's fun. I don't know. I love, anything I write has to be, my favorite shit is, you know, tragedy and comedy.
Absolutely.
You know, I started the Onion was comedy tinged with tragedy.
Sure.
And now I'm kind of trending toward tragedy tinged with comedy, maybe. But it's all the same. It's just a question of ratio.
Yeah.
But it's all tragedy and comedy, which to me is what life is. So for me, you know, my favorite shit is just, I sound like a total, you know, fan, 70s fanboy cliche, but I just love that. Raging Bull.
Yeah, it's best. I think, I can
Boogie
feel
Boogie Nights, Goodfellas stuff. I just love, you know, dark things that are
Well, you definitely,
funny.
That you were able, I think this guy was a good guy to run all that stuff through.
Yeah. That's usually what I,
Yeah.
That's kind of my selection process for a job is like, can I go really dark with this character and can I have a lot of fun with this character?
So it's an 8-episode miniseries.
Yeah, Chip and Nails is it's a limited series, 8 episodes on Hulu.
Yeah. I need to know what happens. I'll watch them. I'm going to watch them.
Or just look on Wikipedia.
No, I don't want to do that.
You could get
what, the whole real story?
No, the true story, yeah.
Yeah. But how long were you kind of fascinated with that guy?
Since I heard, I mean, I didn't know anything about the.
Because like when I saw it, I'm like, that's an interesting angle. Why hasn't anyone else done this? I mean, because I'd forgotten about Chippendales, but it was huge.
Yeah, it was huge, and it seems like one of those true stories that, like, why didn't they make a movie about this 15 years ago? And it's basically because they were trying to.
Or else they didn't think that a lead who was Indian.
That was the other thing is the world came around to. When I first, I mean, this was only 10 years ago when I was trying to get this thing made. That was a real, what's now an asset, you know, diverse storytelling.
Yeah.
That was a real problem when I was trying to make the movie first time around. Was like,
no kidding.
Like, who the hell wants to see a movie about, you know.
An Indian guy.
There's just not enough of an audience for that. And now, everybody's kind of falling over each other to find stories of, you know, that broaden representation.
Yes, inclusive
stories. So we are, I think, a beneficiary of that, certainly.
Absolutely. And then you've got the, you know, the middle-aged Juliette Lewis-ing in the best way.
She's the greatest.
The best.
It's a great cast. Juliette Lewis, Annalee Ashford. I don't know. Do you know Annalee Ashford?
I recognize. I don't know what from, but she's doing.
She was in Impeachment. She was Paula Jones in Impeachment. She's an amazing. She's mostly a Broadway.
She's Kumail's wife.
Yeah, she plays Kumail's wife, and she's incredible.
Paul Snyder was good because I think you had to sort of somehow rein him in from too much Eric Roberts.
Yeah. It's hard to kind of escape the shadow of that.
Right? It kind of is.
And then Murray Bartlett from White Lotus is plays kind of.
Is he British?
He's Australian.
Australian, that's right. He's like doing that Nick DeNoia guy.
He plays
the choreographer and producer.
Who's
and,
the
still got that
antagonist.
Guy. But I think everybody's so jet. You know, he plays a guy who's like clearly on coke very well.
Murray yeah. has, yeah, he's got good coke energy. Yeah. I think he's a pretty clean liver. I don't know.
I know, but like, because that character was starting to grate on me, twitchy. But then you realize like, that's fucking blow and anger.
Blow and anger is a
You know, sort of nebulous sexuality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That produces a certain twitchiness.
Yeah.
He's great at that. So I loved them all. It was a great experience. So.
Well, good job, man. Yeah. Nice talking to you.
Is it over?
Kinda.
How long was that?
Hour 10.
Whoa. Flew by.
Good.
That was fun. Thank you. This is really special for me.
I appreciate it.
It feels like, I've listened to this show for so long and I feel like I made it.
You did. Well,
I really do.
Well, I'm glad to talk to you, man. You do good work.
Thank you.
That was a good talk. I enjoyed that. Welcome to Chippendales premieres tomorrow, November 22nd on Hulu. With new episodes Tuesdays. So, hang out a second, will you? My archive recommendation today, I'm going with episode 837 with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Why that one specifically? Because in addition to talking with Kareem, I also had a return talk with the therapist Phil Stutz. My full talk with Phil was from episode 454, and that's available only for WTF Plus subscribers. But the one from episode 837 is free in all podcast feeds. And if you're planning to watch the new documentary on Netflix called Stutz, you should get yourself up to speed on him because he's definitely a character. These books for me, you know, I read them, you know, I get a little bit out of them and then like I don't finish them. And then I feel like I read halfway through it and I'm like, I got enough. I think you know what I mean? How much of this do I need? I get the idea and I move on.
Yeah, and you have your own TV show now, right?
I do.
So what else could you possibly need?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, Doc, because, I learned is that years ago I always thought, like, well, if money doesn't make you happy, I'd like to figure that. I'd like to find that out firsthand. And, you know, now that I earn a pretty good living, it's definitely changed some fears, and some insecurities. That it put those to rest. But the fundamental stuff, it doesn't change that much.
No, in fact, that's actually the premise of what we do, in other words. And we have some credibility because we treat all these people that are very successful as stars or whatever. And there's what we call a realm of illusion, which is somebody tells himself, if I only get this, my own show, if I only get that, a certain female he wants to marry, whatever it is, that then life will become easy.
Yeah.
And what obviously that never happens.
Never?
No.
In all your experience, no one ever came in and said, hey, you know what? I'm done. I got what I wanted. Thank you.
No one's ever said that. If they do, if it was true, I would try to talk them out of it. It's bad cash flow for us. So we don't really want it anyway.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, that's why a lot of guys will become famous, they'll blow up suddenly, and then they get into drugs and alcohol. Sometimes they even kill themselves. It's like, I did my share. I did what I was supposed to do, which is become famous, very successful. And life still has the same problems. What the fuck, you know?
Right.
I'm being jipped.
Sometimes more problems.
Yeah, sometimes. Or certainly problems you didn't have before.
Yeah, like, you know, what to do with all that money and then how to manage all the shit you bought with it.
That's really overwhelming.
So go listen to that for free right now, episode 837, where you can also hear my talk with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. If you want the full Phil Stutz episode, plus ad-free access to every single episode of WTF, sign up for WTF Plus by going to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. My tour dates are winding down, people. Only three more left this year. My shows at the Orange Peel in Asheville, North Carolina are sold out. Still some tickets for the show in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm at the James K. Polk Center on Saturday, December 3rd. And my HBO taping is at Town Hall in New York City on Thursday, December 8th. There are still tickets for the second show. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. Here's some guitar from back in the day.